Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
So, how's Black Friday going for you? Walmart liked it. Wall Street liked it too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 23rd of November. Glad to have you with us. I don't know if this is cheating or what, but before this day had even really begun, Walmart said it's had its best Black Friday ever. The country's biggest retailer got its holiday sales started last night, as you may have heard. Nearly 10 million transactions between 8 p.m. and midnight. They're still calculating today's tally, but coming through the checkout line so far have been almost 2 million towels, 250,000 bicycles, 1.3 million televisions. Of course, on their way in to buy all that, customers in some stores were met by protests, Walmart workers and community supporters asking for better wages, benefits, and working conditions. Our wealth and poverty reporter Chrissy Clark stopped by a store today to see if shoppers were paying any attention.
Shoppers got an early start this morning at the Walmart in Duarte, California, near Los Angeles.
What are you guys buying?
I bought my daughter a basketball hoop, some dolls and stuff. Toys for Christmas.
Protesters got an early start, too. About 50 marched in front of the store. A dozen or so were Walmart workers, including 24-year-old William Fletcher. He had a candy cane hanging from his T-shirt.
Yeah, a shopper gave it to me. She was like, oh, here, you want a candy cane? It's too cold out here. Why are you here?
He's here, he says, because he thinks his company can afford to pay better wages. Like most Walmart workers, Fletcher works part-time, though he'd like to work more. And after 4 years at the company, he makes about $12,000 annually, goes to food banks, and lives with his mom to save money. He hopes the protest today sends a message to the company and his customers. But he says he gets why people are shopping here today. He shops at Walmart, too.
We're paid so little that in order to get by, I mean, if we're going to have any food that will last us a paycheck, we kind of have to shop here.
And that's the dilemma for a lot of the shoppers I spoke to. Jesus Ponce works at a fast food restaurant and makes minimum wage. He was wheeling out a flat screen TV he just bought on special. He watched the protests for a while.
I support them, but I struggle too, so.
Joanna and Tony Yepes, she's a medical assistant, he's a landscaper, said they don't like what they've read about how Walmart treats its employees.
Bad.
We shop here.
But, you know, whatever's cheaper, I don't care, you know.
A study released this week by the think tank Demos calculated that if large retailers like Walmart raised hourly pay so that employees working full-time made at least $25,000 a year and covered those costs by raising prices, customers would pay about 15 cents more per shopping trip. David Tovar is a spokesman for Walmart.
We think that we have great career opportunities at Walmart, and we have a lot to offer to our 1.3 million associates.
He says that's why Walmart's turnover rate is lower than the industry average. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
A lot of people have the day off today, free to enlist leftovers into sandwich service or to get sucked into Black Friday shopping hype. There is no rest, though, for construction and cleanup workers in the Northeast, still busy after Hurricane Sandy. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports now from New York on what all those swinging hammers could add up to in terms of economic impact.
With many of the storm's path still suffering, it may seem early to talk about the repair effort boosting GDP, but the numbers are too big to ignore. The hurricane tore through expensive and well-insured real estate, so a lot of money will be spent rebuilding homes and businesses.
It's just a broad array of areas that I think will ultimately result in about $125, $150 billion over the course of 2 years.
Bernard Baumol of Economic Outlook Group predicts that even after accounting for the losses for the hurricane, recovery impact will grow the economy by an extra 0.5% next year.
It's going to lead to more employment as well, particularly in the construction field.
Mesirow Financial Chief Economist Diane Swonk doesn't think the effect will be quite as big as he does, but she does expect it to be substantial. Another benefit is local governments get new money to make damaged roads good as new.
Because it comes out of emergency funds, you do get improvements, net improvements to infrastructure.
But there are longer-term costs. States may have to cut services or raise taxes. People may drain their savings to get by after the storm. Moody's Analytics housing economist Celia Chen points out another problem for homeowners.
this does increase insurance costs because the insurance companies are taking a loss, so they will raise premiums and so forth, and that definitely adds to the cost of owning property.
That's the kind of impact that hurts long after the extra construction jobs are gone. But if the boost is as positive as many forecasters predict, it'll be welcome in a region that's ready to be back on its feet. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, hey, look at that, a rally. Dow 13,000. Anybody will have the details when we do the numbers. Been a short week, but a busy one. So 4 minutes of live radio now to recap. Here this week are Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville and Heidi Moore, late of our New York Bureau, now finance and economics editor at The Guardian. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Heidi, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Yeah. Hey, listen, did you get your Black Friday shopping done?
No, I bought some socks. I felt like I was done
so
with my
lame.
Requirements. Also, they were not on sale.
Also, you're not a believer in Black Friday. Well, you are, but you're more of a Monday kind of person.
I'm more of an online kind of person. And it's, you know, it's kind of interesting because the whole Black Friday, Cyber Monday thing, remember when we used to use words like cyber?
Yeah, right.
All of that seems a little, it just seems to have hit some sort of jumping the shark peak. Like it's just gotten
ridiculous. Yes, I like that actually. That's good, jumping the shark.
Yeah, it's hard to participate in it.
So, Cardiff, I mean, you know, Cyber Monday is going to be bigger now than Black Friday for, I think, the second or third year in a row. Why? And we tried to talk about this yesterday on the show. Why do stores persist?
So it's actually fascinating because you really would think the technology and the way that people interact with it would have made all of this obsolete. But there are really powerful sociological and even psychological forces driving people to the stores on this day. I mean, I think there's a couple of reasons. One is just that traditions are hard to eliminate, right? People like their traditions. And another is that I think especially a lot of us in the media tend to overestimate the extent to which people are either comfortable or happy finding deals online. Yeah. For some people, this is just the way they've always done things. And so the stores naturally cater to that. So it's a really intriguing trend to watch. I tend to agree with Heidi that I think Black Friday would probably fade away, but it's going to be a long process.
Yeah, and the diffusion, right? Just because it's spreading out from beyond Black Friday into Thursday and Monday. I mean, it's going to go blah, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, the CEO of Macy's thinks it's enough for his store workers to have to come in at midnight. He's not going to start opening earlier on Thanksgiving so people can basically have their turkey in the store. I mean, we have to have some reasonable, you know, societal expectations about when we go shopping.
And let's be honest, by Thursday night, most of us are in like a Thanksgiving coma all the food.
I'm
not going to the store.
Yeah. All right, on to other things, probably a bit more substantive, one would believe. Europe, they had another budget meeting over there today that fell apart. There is talk of, as Stephen Beard was telling us yesterday, the Brexit, the British exit from the EU, which probably won't happen. What are they doing? Can they fix things, Heidi?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very similar to what's happening here in the U.S. with the fiscal cliff. These are really big decisions about whether how they should spend money and whether they should keep spending money the way that they have. And they're working on a budget that'll last for 10 years or so. So that these are difficult problems. They will eventually get it, you know, fixed. But if one country leaves the euro, they will all leave the euro. That's all you need for a breakup. So there's really kind of a great will to keep them all together.
Cardiff, what do you think? Is the Eurozone going to stay together?
I say yes. And in terms of the budget, I think this is one of those issues where it's hard to parse what matters from what doesn't. So roughly $1 trillion equivalent.
Right.
It sounds like a big deal, but it's spread out over 7 years and across 27 different countries. So in economic terms, purely, it's not that big a deal. But the lesson you can take from it is, number one, that Europe remains this kind of politically divisive kind of place. And number two, you should follow it because it'll tell you something about the direction Europe is going to go in the next decade. Will it take a step in the direction of the U.S. and maybe have less government involvement, or if you're on the other side of the debate, interference in markets? Or will they keep in place the same kind of welfare state policies they've had for a very long time? So it's an intriguing prism through which to view this.
But wait a minute. These guys, I mean, and we got to do this quickly because we're almost out of time. But Heidi, these guys still can't agree on anything, much like the American Congress can't, the Europeans can't.
Right, exactly. But they have the excuse of 27 countries. Yeah. We only have two political parties and we can't get it together. So we shouldn't be too smug about it.
All right. I'm going to squeeze in a third topic because I lied. You didn't have 40 seconds. but that's okay. Fiscal cliff, going to be fixed? Yes or no, Heidi?
Yes, but with a patch. And I think fixed. No. Then I'm changing it to no.
Cardiff?
Half yes, half no. I mean, the really important things they'll get through, the taxes and things like that. Yeah. Some of the stuff will, in fact, lapse probably. But I think in terms of what its effect is going to be on the economy, I think ultimately it'll be negligible.
Yeah. Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville. Heidi Moore from The Guardian. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kai.
See you. Have a good weekend.
You too.
There was baseball news this week. Yes, baseball. There's big doings down in Miami. Commissioner Bud Selig has approved a trade that sent basically all the Miami Marlins' high-priced talent off to the Toronto Blue Jays. Took the Marlins way out of sight of the playoffs for years to come. And the trade comes not long after taxpayers built the Marlins a fancy new stadium. Phil Latzman reports now from Miami that the deal has fans and politicians down there hopping mad.
A small group of fans recently gathered at the Marlins' new half-billion-dollar stadium in Miami's Little Havana to protest, both in Spanish and in English.
New owner for the Marlins.
They want new owners after the team's latest purge, the trade of all-stars Jose Reyes, Mark Burley, and Josh Johnson to the Blue Jays in return for seven mostly unknown players. The move, which came after the team finished in last place, will save the Marlins over $160 million in future payroll obligations. And it comes within a year of moving into their new, mostly taxpayer-funded stadium. Last year at this time, the team's owners promised to spend money to beef up the franchise and make it competitive in its new Miami home. But this latest fire sale has Marlins fans feeling they've been duped.
My name is George Hidalgo. I've been supporting the Marlins since 1993 when they first came out. I feel betrayal, devastating, shocked.
Harold De La Cruz is standing nearby and holding up a sign.
It says, Loria, sell the team and leave town. Sign the fans.
Marlins owner Jeffrey Luria is the subject of the fans' ire. He put $120 million of his own money into building the ballpark, but that was a mere fraction of the over $600 million in total costs. De La Cruz says he feels the team betrayed its community.
We were bought into this. You know, we have a winning strategy. We're going to win. We're going to win games. You know, we have a new manager, a new ballpark, new players. You know, when they sold everything else, we're thinking about our tax dollars going into the stadium because we're going to be paying this for, you know, 40 years.
That's because over the next four decades, local municipalities will use $2.4 billion in tourist taxes to pay off the stadium's debt. Miami-Dade County is on the hook for the bulk of the financing. Mayor Carlos Jimenez was opposed to the deal as a county commissioner when it was agreed upon 3.5 years ago. So was this his I-told-you-so moment?
The deal for the stadium was one thing. That was horrible. The I-told-you-so came later on the deal when we found out, in fact, they had a lot more money to put up than that they were saying.
Mayor Jimenez says the county is locked into a bad deal.
There was no revenue sharing, nothing whatsoever. We didn't get any revenue from the naming rights. We don't get any revenue from concessions. We get nothing. All we got was all the debt. That's not right.
Earlier this week, Marlins general manager Larry Beinfest defended the trades and said it wasn't about the money.
I think the fans have every right to be concerned. I think that they can be disappointed in the way we've played. We've won a bunch of games, you know, ranking in the lower third in payrolls. And frankly, we just don't talk about payroll. We needed players. We needed good players that we can build a championship quality team around. And that's what this thing is about.
Still, the Marlins' latest purge leaves the team with an opening day payroll of $36 million, which would be the lowest in Major League Baseball. In Miami, I'm Phil Latzman for Marketplace.
Coming up, places where a $100 bill is so much more.
In other countries, countries that are much poorer, these are saved. People sock them away. They're not out there buying milk and bananas with them every day.
But first, let's do the numbers. In a short trading day, the Dow Industrials rang up 172 points, 1.3% for the blue chips, finished at 13,009. The NASDAQ lit up 40 points, nearly 1.4%, closed at 2966. The S&P 500 put on 18 points, 1.3%, ended at 1409. For the week, the Dow climbed 3.3%, the NASDAQ 4%, the S&P 500 3.2%. Retailers had a good day on Wall Street as well as in the mall. In the big box arena, Walmart gained 1.9%, Target 1.2%. Among department stores, Macy's gained 1.75%, Nordstrom added 1.7%. What about the objects of shoppers' desire? Apple rose 1.75%. Coach bagged 2.3%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. Teavana reports earnings. The tea company may be owned by Starbucks by the end of the year. In Washington, D.C., the People's Christmas Tree arrives at the Capitol Building. This year's spruce comes from the state of Colorado. And on this day, in 1942, the beginning of a beautiful friendship, the film Casablanca had its world premiere in New York. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, so here you go. Follow me now. Death, taxes, and if I might improvise a little bit, Obamacare. The president's reelection means the Affordable Care Act is certain. What it will mean for certain employees is anything but part-timers, for one good example, people who work 30 hours a week. Because come 2014, some companies will be required to offer health insurance to anybody who works, yes, 30 hours. And that, as Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports now from the health desk at WHYY, has those employers worrying full time.
The math just didn't add up for the Community College of Allegheny County in western Pennsylvania. Health care for 400 part-time staff and faculty would cost the school an extra $6 million a year.
We just simply do not have room in the budget to absorb that kind of cost.
That's David Hoover, a spokesperson for the college. So, come December 31st, the school will cut hours for part-time professors and secretaries. They won't just miss out on insurance, they'll take a pay cut, too.
They're not happy about this, and quite frankly, we aren't either. Unfortunately, there just isn't really an alternative for us at this time.
This 30-hour-a-week provision in the Affordable Care Act is forcing employers to make hard choices. Paul Fronston with the Employee Benefits Research Institute says businesses must decide whether they can afford to give insurance to workers who don't get it today.
And if I can't afford to pay for it, will my business suffer if I cut back on their hours?
For many employers, it's too early to tell how things will play out. But Towers Watson consultant Jerry Recht says there will be a lot of experimentation. She says she can imagine a day when some employers just stop providing insurance and sweeten the pot in other ways.
Maybe we'll give them an increased 401k plan or 403b contribution. Maybe we'll increase their pay.
Rec says in that case, workers would buy their own plans from the publicly run health exchanges. She says maybe it'd be cheaper than what the boss could get you. Plus, you'd be making more money. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
With the economy the way it is, and with so many people wanting college degrees as a way to improve their job prospects, you'd think art schools would be having a hard time because they are among the most expensive colleges out there. And career prospects? Well, let's just say nobody goes to art school to get rich, right? But demand is so strong at one of those schools, it's had to get creative to feed its students. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Maryland, Amy Scott reports.
In a food truck parked outside MICA, the Maryland Institute College of Art, Russell Imwald works the lunch rush. This week's special, a deep-fried peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
Last week I did like bacon chili cheeseburger french fries, and that was really popular.
A food truck near a college campus? Not much new there, except this truck is actually owned by the college. Maggie Sabo works the counter. She says Micah needed a mobile kitchen to serve a growing campus of far-flung buildings near downtown Baltimore.
We realized that to meet the needs of the students and where the students are, it's easier for us to go to them.
Never mind all the fuss these days about the need to get a practical education. Enrollment at Micah has grown by more than 50% in the last decade to about 2,200 students. It's added 7 new graduate programs in the last few years. That's a lot more mouths to feed.
There's nothing on the menu that's over $8, and, you know, things start around $1.50, so that's totally, you know, grab a snack on a budget, it's fine.
Full disclosure, my husband works at Micah. When he first told me about the food truck, students and faculty had been asked to vote on the name. Cook Russell Imwald says they chose the Starving Artist, but the administration thought better of it.
A lot of people took exception with that, I guess because so many artists after graduating are starving.
Not quite the message you want to send when you charge $38,000 a year tuition. They went with the Artist's Palette instead. Get it? Micah is well aware that many families are starting to question the price of art school. Teresa Bedoya is vice president of admissions and financial aid. She says applications fell last year for the first time in 20 years. The college is spending a lot of time trying to figure out how to reduce costs.
It's absolutely in the forefront of our thinking at this time because the economy has been in a recession. People are asking these questions more and more about the value of higher education. But we've for years have said this is not a sustainable model.
Can I just get the black bean and cheese quesadilla?
Okay. Anything extra?
No, thanks.
Micah senior Erica Sadler stopped by the food truck for a quick $4 bite on her way from a work-study job. She's an interdisciplinary sculpture major, which includes performance art and installation.
This year, my thesis is all about outdoor survival and outdoor living. So I'm making a hammock, and I've made, some herbal tinctures and stuff like that.
Sadler says she'll graduate with $120,000 in student loans.
Did you know that going into art school? I mean,
I knew I was going to have loans, but I kind of wish someone would have, knocked some sense into me. I was, 18 years old, thinking I had to go to college and not thinking about the financial issues. And now I'm like, oh, my God, why did my parents let me go here?
Micah's Teresa Bedoya says she has those conversations with students to make sure they understand what they're getting into. But when studying art is their dream, she says they often don't want to hear it. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
All right, here's one of those stories that make you kind of go, I didn't know that. Turns out almost 80% of the currency in circulation in this country is $100 bills. It's true. I know it's true because Matt Phillips told me so. He's a reporter with Quartz. It's the new business website from The Atlantic. And we called him up to find out what people are doing with all those Benjamins. Hey, Matt, thanks for coming on the program.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me.
You betcha. But, listen, here's the thing. There aren't a whole lot of things that you need to plunk down a $100 bill in this economy for, cash on the barrel end, right? So is it possible that all these bills are being used nefariously?
Well, yeah, that gets at what you mean by the economy, because people say that large dollar-denominated bills are the currency of choice for all sorts of things that happen in what's elegantly called the informal economy. It could call it the black market or underground economy, too.
But that's right. I mean, that's sort of what's going on here, you think.
It could be. It could be. It could also be good old-fashioned tax evasion, cash business. That could be part of it. The other thing that people point to is that in other countries that are much poorer, these are saved. People sock them away. They're not out there buying milk and bananas with them every day.
So if you went to Africa or Southeast Asia, you might find just literally people just hanging on to them and putting them under the mattresses.
Yeah, you might. You probably wouldn't find them just because they want to keep them out of sight.
They would be hidden. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Do we know how much U.S. currency is running around overseas versus domestic?
No. Strangely, no one seems to really know exactly. There have been a few attempts to try to at least get a sense, but those have been pretty wildly disparate. Like in the 90s, there was this one number that was set around 70% of U.S. currency was circulating overseas. More recent numbers have pegged it around 25-30%.
This is all the more interesting because we are now in an age where you're increasingly plastic, you're paying for stuff with a credit card, or you're using your phone, for crying out loud.
Right, right. It does seem to sort of fly in the face of that notion that we are going to have a cashless economy. You can see some of that show up if you look at the data of smaller denomination bills. That's another reason why economists think that a lot of these dollars are going overseas. Yeah. If you were going to make a purchase in the U.S. for a couple hundred dollars or so, you'd probably still use debit or credit or plastic of some sort to do it. That's kind of why another reason why people think it might be a foreign phenomenon.
Yeah. Pull out your wallet. What do you got in it right now?
I've got a little bit of cash right now.
Do you really?
I got about 60 bucks, but 20.
60 bucks, but so you don't have a $100 bill in your pocket, do you?
No. I don't. Although one economist kind of went into, you know, if this currency supply was spread evenly across the 300 million Americans that are out there, the average American would have something like 2,300 bills in their wallet.
Wow. That's nuts. That is also not me. Matt Phillips is a reporter for Quartz. It's the finance and economic news site that is brought to you by the good people at The Atlantic. Matt, thanks a lot.
Hey, thanks, Guy.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, after which I'm sad to say your satisfaction at all the Black Friday bargains you got this morning, or last night for that matter, may well evaporate. In the pages of the Wall Street Journal today, I saw this, a study by the pricing research firm Decide, showing a good chunk of those doorbuster deals and amazing prices were not only available at other times of the year, but they were cheaper then, to boot. So next year, do yourself a favor. Just sleep in. Well, yeah, it'll be better for everybody. All right, we got to go. That's Marketplace on a Friday from 8 p.m. Today, the Dow climbed 172 points, 1.3%. The NASDAQ gained 40 points, about the same percentage-wise. The S&P 500 up 18 points, 1.3%. Our theme music is composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, ladies and gentlemen, from the cockpit, welcome aboard. Airfares are going up.
When jet fuel goes up in price, it becomes more expensive to fly. When pilots go up in price for airlines, it also becomes more expensive to fly.
They get you coming and going, don't they? I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend. We'll be back here on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.